Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read. As I read it, there's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book. I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to and hopefully enjoy. Joining me today, like normal, is Juliana.
Hello everyone.
And today we are going to be talking about a Hugo award-winning book. Last year's Hugo award-winning book. Just to put this into context, here we go. I'm gonna go back over some of the previous books that I've reviewed this year. Earth Abides, 4.5 stars. Neverness by David Zindel, 4.5 stars. Terminal World by Alice Reynolds, 4 stars. Adrian Tchaikovsky, Alien Clay, 4.5 stars.
Mm-hmm.
Tolkien, The Silmarillion, 5 stars. Yeah. Fellowship of the Rings, 2 towers, Return of the King, The Lord of the Rings in total, 4.5 stars.
Yeah.
And now...
There's quite a trend visible there.
What do you mean a trend?
It's all really highly rated.
Here's the thing, it's because I've been rereading books which could be on the SFBRP must reads list. This collection of 52 books, I think it's 53 books now, where it's sort of like, these are must reads. These are ones that are standing the test of time. These are formative books. There's a lot to sink your teeth into here as well.
Yes.
You know, things like, I've opened the wrong thing here as well. So, Ursula K. Le Guin, Kurt Vonnegut, David Brin, Kim Stanley Robinson, you know, like big hitters and things like that.
Yes.
And then... Also, these are all rereading these authors who are generally considered for me.
You've read these books before and had a good memory of it.
Every single one of these is a reread.
Yes.
You know, the only book that I've read this year, which hasn't been a reread of a book which I already know is good and should be on a masterworks, or fucking Lord of the Rings and Silmarillion, yeah, which are like not small books, like in terms of, you know, regard by the world.
Yes.
The first book that I read this year, Micaiah Johnson, Those Beyond the Wall, which is Space Between Worlds, number 2, 0.5 stars. So the books that I've gone so far are like Lord of the Rings and Masterworks level books, or books by favorite authors that I'm rereading or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And Micaiah Johnson, 0.5 stars. So today...
That also was a book that just came out, wasn't it?
A recent book. Yeah, it's from like last year.
Yeah.
Or 2 years. Yeah, over the last few years. Because it was the follow-up to a book that is actually on the SFBRP...
Yeah, we both really enjoyed
and
the
And it's on the SFBRP
book.
Must Reads list, which is The Space Between Worlds. So now we get last year's Hugo Award winner. Is this going to be a, like, 4.5, 5-star book like these others? Or is it going to be a 0.5-star book like The Space Between Worlds
Or something in
book?
Between?
It's going to be kind of in between. It's definitely not a 0.5-star book because I finished it. And that's always the kind of thing. Like, if I don't finish a book and I abandon it, not because it just wasn't for me, but it was actually, you know, not for me, but also not fun and not good in ways. But that's not what this book is. This book is not good in other ways, but it's not unreadably bad.
Okay, I have no idea what book we're talking about.
Tell me what book. I thought I'd mention Some Desperate Glory by Emily Tesh.
Right.
And I made quite a few notes because, well, here's the thing. You start reading a book like this and you're like, oh, very, very promising. And so this is my overall view. First third of the book, very promising. This is really good. Like, gets that third of the way in, like at the end of kind of what felt like a novella length story.
Yeah.
And there's something big happens, and I'm like, wow, that's a big swing. How is the book still got 2/3 of the book left to go after that has happened? And then something disappointing happens, and then other things disappointing happens, and then our main character gets more and more stupid, and the world gets more and more stupid.
Oh,
until
no.
At the end, I'm like, oh, I thought this was sort of like something which had a young character in, which felt like, oh, this is a book about... Like, not all coming-of-age stories are children's books or kids' books or young adult books,
yeah,
or whatever. Not every story about a young adult is a young adult book. Like, even something like Ender's Game, it's a book about children,
yeah,
but it's not like a children's book. Maybe a child could have, like, more in common with the characters in it, but it's talking about, like... adult themes and adult, like, you know, it's talking about war and responsibility and leadership, yes, and yes, all these big
in the
topics.
Same way that Dune kind of is as well, right?
Dune,
yeah,
about a coming of age, somebody starting off as a kid and ending up as an adult and, you know, emperor and messiah or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Like, there's coming of age stories which aren't always young adult books.
Yeah.
And this book started off as something which I thought, oh, this is like a toothy novel. What am I trying to say? Something you can get your teeth into, something that has fangs, you know, in both directions. Like, it's biting at me and I'm like chewing on it, if you know what I mean.
Okay, yes.
And it ended up as young adult dreck, which is a real pity because it had a lot of promise at the start. So much so that at the end of the last episode, I was like, hey, I tried the Transformers. No, not the Transformers. What is it? Terraformers. That's it. I tried the Terraformers by Annalie Nevitz and abandoned that because it was just garbage. You know, that was just a book which I was like, this is so bad. It's so garbage. I'm not going to continue on with it. I'm just going to ask for the Audible credit back.
Okay.
Because it was like terribly...
wasn't even mentioned, no rating,
no nothing. It was terribly written and science fictionally bad. And I don't mind if something's science fictionally bad if it's well written, because I'm like, well, I'm going, like, it's doing something else here. Like, it's not concerned about, does all the science make sense?
Right. And you were not the only person with that kind of opinion, were
no,
you?
No, of course not. Yeah. No, I mean, a lot of these books are very well loved. People really enjoy them. But yeah. Here's the thing. This book, just disappointing.
This book,
Some Desperate Glory by Emily Tesh.
Okay.
So I'm going to go through the notes because, again, I don't want this podcast to last a long time here as well. So it starts really well, and it starts off with someone who is in like this fascist spaceship war cult. Earth has been destroyed.
Yes.
And there's not very much of humanity left. But a big part of humanity is on this space station, like 2,000 people on this space station, which is like a rock with different like battleships attached to it.
Okay.
I think there's like 4 battleships attached to this floating rock. And this is a station which is being run by the general Joel. His name is. And he's decided that the war, everybody else thinks the war is over, but the war is still going on. And
the war between humans?
Between humans and the aliens who destroyed
Earth. Oh, there were aliens.
So there's aliens, the Majo, I think it's called. Let me have a quick
aliens.
Look. Aliens.
Aliens destroying
Wikipedia page.
Earth. Okay.
Yeah, so they're living on Gaia Station. Yes, it's the Majo. And it starts off pretty interesting. It starts off like, hey, we're in the battle school, you know. It's very much in dialogue with Ender's Game to the point that it starts off with the Earth being destroyed, and then you realize, oh no, this is like a computer simulation of the Earth being destroyed, and it's a training simulation. You're like, all right, training simulation, right? So, and also the person, so it's difficult to distinguish between the reality of the training simulation and reality.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
And you straight away, you're like, ah, right, Ender's Game, child soldier camp. So we're training children from a young age to become soldiers and leaders and do suicide missions and all that kind of stuff. So it starts off like, this is really good and things like that. And it's also boarding school kind of straight away. Like I'm saying, oh, this feels very British boarding school where there's a class and a house and these are the sparrow, this is the sparrow class. Right. And it's all the girls who are going, and then there's the cat clan and the raccoon clan or whatever it is, you know, these different age groups that go up. And I was like, oh, it feels very, you know, like British public, like you know, in America they call them private schools, like the public schools, a bit Hogwarts with the different houses and things.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. And you get the Sorting Hat moment at the end where they're like, and now for the rest of your life you're going to be in command, and you're going to be in the lights, sun viewers, I think it's all like the solar, you're going to look after solar panels, you're going to be over in computer systems, you're going to be in the creche, in other words, you're a woman, and you're going to be sent to just have babies and look after children and try and repopulate the world. And there's, you're going to go off and be a soldier, you know, and Valkyr is her name, Valkyrie is what she's called in this part of the book. And she is being trained from birth to become, you know, command and you know,
like
she's a super soldier.
Valkyrie,
she is 2 meters tall. It's built like a tank, I think it said in the book. Okay. Don't look at this, because this is sort of like, hey, she's, you know, just a, you know, 17-year-old or whatever it is.
Okay, yeah. But so no. You're pointing at the cover of the book. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm thinking like shoulders like twice as wide as that and or whatever. Either way. So and the first big twist, where I thought, oh, this is really fun, is that she is assumes she's going to be sent to command or become a soldier or go into whatever this squad is. And instead, she is put in the creche. So she is told, hey, you're going to go over and just become a baby-making machine and look after babies. And she revolts against that. And that is the start of her revolting and rebelling against the kind of fascist child soldier boarding school dystopian. When I say bottle dystopian, it's a bit like, you know, like the Silo movie, you know, so everyone is like contained. It's like a set number of people.
And some people decide over what your destiny is going to be.
Yeah, and everything is controlled. And there's like a caste system, like you're over here, you're over there. And I was like, hey, that's really good. And this is the whole part which I thought was interesting. And I thought her being put in the creche would kick off a thing which means that she would like recognize this and it would be all internal to this space station. But it doesn't. It suddenly, she escapes and gets away and follows her brother off the station and kidnaps another alien that they'd got before, whatever, and leaves. And I'm like, oh, it's just become a dumb adventure story. And then they go to another planet where there's some other humans. And it's okay. But what I wanted was I wanted the action to happen inside this, you know, this bottle fascism dystopia.
Yeah.
That for me was where the interestingness, like the interest in the story here was, let's go up against there. But there's like this Deus Ex Machina escape kind of thing. And then it's, and I'm like, oh, it was just too easy. She could just leave. Oh, you could just leave. Oh, it turns out if you could just leave.
Right.
Other people can't leave, but she just like, oh, I just left. And then like the story was kind of taken out of her hands in that way.
To me, that sounds like a very ambitious writer and having a really interesting story idea.
Yeah.
And then writing it down and then figuring out, but how can I resolve this without too much conflict?
Well, here's the thing. Yeah. In the end, it's resolved like this, like the conflict is resolved without the main character having to make the hard decision.
Right.
Which is fine. That's okay, because it's at the start of the book.
Sometimes you have to run away.
Yeah. So anyway, I did look up Emily Tesh. It says she's grew up in London. Tesh attended Trinity College in Cambridge. You recognize this? We've been there.
Yes.
We visited a friend of yours who was doing a master's course there, didn't we?
Yes.
So we've been there. So it's funny when I was saying like, oh, this feels like British public school houses and stuff like that. Yeah. Went to Trinity College. It's like, it's weird for this like battle school to be like coded British boarding school in a way which isn't in, say, Ender's Game or whatever. So here's the thing. They go out and it gets stupider. There's like the world's most dangerous technology, which can kill, like magical technology that can destroy worlds.
Wait, that's magic?
It again, any sufficiently advanced science is indistinguishable from magic. So there's this, the wisdom, it's called.
Right.
Again, I don't need to explain it all, but it's like this computer which is so powerful that it can bend space and time to its own needs.
Interesting.
So if you got like something that's that powerful, you'd think that, hey, there should be like a lot of security around this place. And the security is like a tiger and like five humans. And
a tiger?
Look, I'm not going to explain it, because it felt like something that was clever at the time. And looking back, as soon as you realize how important this is, you're like, how can like one computer nerd and like a brother and sister super soldiers destroy the known galaxy? You know, it's that kind of level. And again, I don't want to go too much into it, but if there's that much power, how can the security be so weak? And anyway, as this book goes on, things get more and more stupid. And I've tried to avoid as many spoilers as possible, like I've kind of given the setup to the book. But it just gets more stupid. And our main character, like the more she learns about the world, the more stupid she gets. And in the end, she becomes, it's this terrible, like, young adult style thing where, oh, if you just make the right decisions, things will go correctly and people will follow you and you'll be able to defeat the enemy by you just being goodish, like gooder than you were before. Or gooder than the other people around you.
Okay.
And it doesn't work. And I get the point where one of the characters is sort of like, hey, are the children running things now? And I'm like, I know! What the fuck are the children? And it's just one of these things where you just go, why are the old people suddenly sacrificing themselves to help the young idiot people stuff?
How old are we talking about?
17, 18 years old. They're twins, the main characters.
Right.
So anyway... So that's the setup. Just in general, if it was just the action and the politics and the other stuff going in the book, like, it started off with so much promise. This is why I said, hey, you because you have it on hold with the library.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I'll wait until you finish the book and then we'll review it together. And I got through to the end of the book.
Take 6 weeks for me to get that book.
It could be a long time. But if it was a good book, I'd be like, well, I'll just buy you the Kindle ebook. You know, I've still got, you know, gift card credits left over from ages ago or whatever. We don't get. And I was like, well, I'll just pay for the book and you read it. If it was a good book, I'd be like, yes, go for it. This is the book that you want. Turns out, this is not a good book. And I was like, don't bother reading this book.
It's not holding up. So, but wait a second. This book...
won the Hugo Award.
Last year.
Yeah, I'll get into it if I want.
Okay, wow.
So here's the thing. That's the big kind of thing. I'm going to get into like mild spoiler territory here. But I think this is important to talk about the other disappointingness of the book.
Yeah.
I'm going to, and the spoilers that I'm going to give is a novel called Ender's Game. So if you've never read Ender's Game or watched the movie.
Go and read Ender's Game.
He's playing a game all the time. And it turns out at the end of the book, the game isn't a game. Mm-hmm. He's actually been playing real battles and he's been winning real battles. So that he's doing a speed run of this battle simulation kind of thing.
Yes.
It turns out that all the time he was doing that, he thought he was just playing a game.
Real life consequences.
Mm-hmm. And in the end, he's sort of like, I'm gonna 100% no hit speed run this final boss. And he does. And at the end of it, what does he do? He wipes out an entire sentient alien race.
Yes.
Because he thought it was just a game. It wasn't just a game, but he was playing to win. Mm-hmm. And that's what they needed. They needed this super soldier, you know, genetic engineered child, military and leadership and tactical genius to do. So again, this book feels like this, you know, there's some desperate glory. Feels like in dialogue with that. Super soldier kids playing computer games as training, you know, as part of that.
Yes.
Here's the thing. In the world of these books, where there is a computer game, the computer game can affect the real world, or the computer game exists in the real world, and it's used to affect the real world via, like, Ready Player One kind of things. If you win at this game, you win the $1 billion or get control of the computer. You know, I don't mind there being virtual reality worlds within our world.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with this book is the computer, the wisdom that's called, the Majo wisdom, the alien computer, that it's so powerful that when you change the simulation, it can change reality.
Right. So it is an alien computer.
Yes. I mean, the humans have a version of it, the smaller version they have.
Yeah.
They have, like, when it opens up, it's like the human version of that.
Okay.
And it turns out that the reason why the aliens wanted to destroy Earth is because the computer does a simulation and works through the big computer, the alien computer, is so powerful. It looks through all of the possible futures and it says, hey, what you should do is this.
Yes.
And it did that for a while until the aliens were like, it just keeps always comes up with the best result. Mm. So why do we keep asking it? We'll just let it run things for us, if you know what I mean. If it can just constantly sit there and simulate the future and work out what the best outcome is going to be, it should just be running the place.
Right.
And that's
it makes
what it's
sense.
Doing.
Yes.
But that means that when it looked at humanity, the opening of the book's quite clever because it's like an alien anthropological or, you know, a science study about humans are like, yeah, they're really dangerous. Like, you know, the men are really violent and even the women can break our legs. You know, it's all like this. And they look at Earth and go, ah, Earth is going to get hold of this same technology.
Right.
And we can't have two wisdoms. We can't have two of these things going on. Humans are way too dangerous. What we need to do is we need to take the legs out from underneath you. If we destroy Earth, that'll set them back long enough that we can then integrate them into our, you know, alien. There's lots of different alien species, and they all kind of, you know, there's like 17 different alien species that all live together in harmony. If we take out planet Earth, humans can integrate with us at the level that they should be rather than overpower us and win the war.
That's like a really fun setup.
It is a fun set. Again, it's a fun idea and a fun setup. That's the reason why it is. But here's the thing. If humans then can take control of this or have this same power, that's bad. But my problem is that unlike these other books which have computer games in them or computer simulations in them, even like The Matrix, which everything's happening in the computer game, everything's happening in The Matrix. But what they're actually, the thing that really matters is the humans outside, like the human characters. Like the whole point is not being in there. In this book, the computer game is the world, or the world is the computer game. So if the computer game, if you like mess up in the computer game, you're like, oh, let's just go back to the previous checkpoint. You know, this is what you do when you're playing a computer game. You do like the save hacking. You
go
know.
Back to the save point.
Yeah, you're like, oh, I messed up. Well, I saved right there. So then you kill one enemy and save, and then you kill the next enemy and save. Like that kind of stuff. But it's not clever enough to be like a Groundhog Day kind of thing where we keep going back and winning, like trying out the same battle. And it's not like you know, Live, Die, Repeat or whatever that movie is called.
Yeah.
It's doing something different. But what it means is I don't care anymore, because at any point you can just rewind a bad decision, rewind a failure, and go back to a different place.
Ah.
And at one point, someone actually says, I thought I made a note of it here. Where did I make it? No, I didn't make a note of it. But what even said, it's sort of like someone said, I can't remember what it says, but it's sort of like, oh yeah, we got the cheat codes. It's like one of the characters says, it's like we've got cheat codes, which is fine if the cheat codes aren't cheat codes for the novel itself.
Yeah.
It felt like Emily Tesh wrote herself into some different corners and then was like, let me press the cheat code button, you know, up, down, left, right, A, B, A, B, or whatever the Konami code is. Probably wrong. Don't write in to correct me about this. But it's like, don't tell me that your characters have cheat codes for the world and winning.
Yes.
It's that very unsatisfying when the characters themselves are saying it's like having cheat codes.
Yeah. Also, that diminishes everything, every sort of conflict or drama is being diminished by you knowing you can just erase it and go back.
Yeah.
Nothing has consequences, right?
Nope. Exactly. That's my whole point.
Yeah.
Is that what's the quickest way for me to now, in any movie that I watch, not care about what's going on, is that it's a multiverse, if you know what I mean. So I'm like, oh, we failed in this timeline. Well, let's just go over to this other timeline. We failed over here in this world. Well, we can just go and get that character died here and it was a big sacrifice. Well, let's just go and get that character again from this other timeline, bring them over here, and then they can just exist over here again or whatever. Like it makes sacrifice mean nothing. Yeah. It makes failure mean nothing. It makes making wrong decisions mean nothing. Or it makes somebody making a big decision which will have either good or bad consequences in the future mean nothing.
Yes.
As soon as you introduce time travel, which can fix things, or multiverses, where you can, you know, move problems over there or bring them back again. Either the book has to be about that. Like, so I don't mind if that happens, you know, like time loops or timelines or whatever. Mm. But then that's what the story has to be about.
Yeah.
You can't then just tell a normal, oh, fight against fascism, young person coming of age, young adult style storytelling where at any point, it doesn't matter because they can just grab some memories from a different place over there.
Makes sense, because then it's kind of... I just had a really good thought and then...
Okay, don't worry about it.
Anyway, it's... it is diminishing everything about learning from mistakes. And also, the consequences and the meaning is lost in this kind of, if you don't, if you can't look at the thing and then come to conclusions.
No, you can't. That's the thing. At any point, again, the setup is stupid, but then it becomes unsatisfying from a narrative point of view.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the character development of our main character, Kia. She, at some point, goes over to another timeline, but she doesn't. But she suddenly has the memories from two timelines. So she turns up, and she's also at the timeline of... like, there's just a different timeline. I'm not going to go into it, because it's a bit spoilerish. It doesn't matter. But in the other timeline, she's gay and a different personality. Hmm. Suddenly, she has... and then she goes back into a previous timeline, like into the original timeline again. But she still has the memories from the timeline where she was more successful, her parents hadn't died, and she was gay. And so all of the lessons that I wanted her to learn along the way, she didn't. She just had a different personality implant from a different timeline version, like an alternative reality version of her, suddenly implants that into her current personality or brain, and then there's these two characters living alongside each other again, which is very 2000s. It's very Nine Fox Gambit. Let's put this other personality in here and have two different personalities, all these. Yeah, it's exactly this kind of thing. All of this is very, very modern in this way that you have these two. But it doesn't, it's just unsatisfying. How much did she, how many mistakes did she learn and how did she learn from what she did? But then it's sort of over here, there's this other thing going on. And I was like, was she originally gay? Was she gay, in the original timeline, but then she didn't realize it? So I was like, it was only because she was gay in another timeline and she knew she was gay there that she... And I was like, this is... And I was like, is this, what is this saying about someone, someone's, sexuality, alignment or whatever, whatever it's going to be. Her brother's been gay all the time. We always know her brother's gay, but whatever. But she wasn't. Was she? Whatever.
She bi?
I don't know. Again, it's confusing because it was sort of now she couldn't look at this person again because in this other timeline she had kissed her, and now in this timeline she had these feelings for her, but the partner in this timeline. And I was like, this is saying a lot. Meanwhile, battles against fascism and, teaming up and people sacrificing themselves. And I was like, this whole is she gay or not gay or whatever, stuff like that. So brings on to the general politics, which is very unsatisfying, is that if you're an old man, equals bad. Older woman equals good. Old man who has an old wife is good. Young man who is gay is good. Other young men is obviously bad, but is actually good, but he's also gay. And I'm like, it's one of these really weird things, sort of very in this very tall wave squeakcore kind of thing. Power is bad unless it's being wielded by a young gay woman. And it's pure wizards versus lesbians. This book is 100% wizards versus lesbians in that way.
Right.
Is that it's this, it's just this weird vibe where killing people is really bad unless, and so we have to defeat the person who is killing people, except because we're young and lesbian, it's okay for us to take power away from the person who's killing people. It's really bad for these other people to destroy a planet, except we're young and gay and are we white? It doesn't say, so let's say, and it's just this weird kind of thing. It's sort of I wish the world was just that easy. But it isn't that easy. And to have everything reduced down to, if you are young, or put it this way, if you are not of the previous generation, you are good and pure and can be trusted. And I'm like, but the guy who you keep trusting is the main villain. It reminds me of the Planetfall series where, what's the one where, Beyond Mars, and I can't remember what it's called, one of those ones where you're like, you're the psychopath. You don't understand it, but we're reading a book about from the psychopath's point of view.
Yes.
And I'm reading this book and I'm like, stop giving responsibility to the known psychopath who this same person in the future, in a different timeline, but in the future, is the worst person in the known galaxy. This person is the most dangerous person in the known galaxy. Every time in the past, in other timelines, that you've ever given him any power and responsibility, he's used it for bad, for evil. He is the worst person. And she's sort of like, oh yeah, and if you could just do this for me. And then, like, you know, 10 minutes later in the audiobook, you're like, oh, so now everybody's in danger and thousands of people are going to die because you gave responsibility to this known worst person in the galaxy? The most dangerous worst person in the galaxy? But it's like, oh no, but he's young and cute and gay and he's like the love interest of my gay brother. So I'll just keep trusting the most dangerous person in the known galaxy. It's so stupid and so bad, and I'm like so conflicted about the politics, because it's all of this kind of like identity politics mixed up, where you're like, oh, he was bad, he was just old, he was just an old creep who was like running this fascist society as like a you know, he had his own harem, you know, of young girls who he could fuck, because it was sort of, no, we're gonna repopulate humanity, let's get on with it, sort of like, yeah, okay, so just a random cult leader, whatever. Like, I'd be a lot more afraid of someone who is willing to just sacrifice thousands and thousands or millions or billions or trillions of people just to get revenge or whatever is going on like this. It's sort of like, who am I going to trust? In that situation, I would trust the old creep who's raping young girls rather than the person who is willing to sacrifice thousands or millions or billions or even trillions of people. Like, who are you going to trust? The old rapist or the person who is happy to commit genocide? This book does not grapple with this at all, and it's in the text of the book. Young person who's gay and good looking and but is like literally worse than Hitler? Or some old creep who is trying to get humanity back online and rape some girls. It's sort of like,
how about none of these people?
Yes, it would be easier if that was the solution, but the book doesn't do that. Because it loses control. Like Emily Tesh loses control of what the book is about.
Right. Yeah, it sounds like it's grappling with all the topics.
And it was only because I listened to this Wizards versus Lesbians podcast that they talked about a book, which I didn't read, but I mentioned it to you. It's called Fangirl, and it's about it's about someone who is, it's like a novel about someone who writes fan fiction. Mm-hmm. And they mentioned in that it's mostly heterosexual women writing fan fiction about heterosexual men in novels like Harry Potter or whatever, and it's, or you know, Lord of the Rings, and they're like, we want these two characters who aren't gay in the book to be gay, so let's write fan fiction about them. This book, the gay relationship, between the brother
in the Emily Tesh
book, feels like someone said, these two characters probably shouldn't be homosexual, but it would be better for, you know, fan fiction reasons if they were already homosexual, so let's just make them a homosexual couple. It isn't that case, but it's just one of those things where I'm like, this homosexual relationship here feels like it's being written from a non-male homosexual point of view. And I say that as someone who isn't homosexual, but I'm like, these two side characters having a relationship feels like fan fiction of itself.
Right. No,
I thought I was thinking that I made a note of it, and then when I was looking through other Goodreads reviews to see another thing that I found problematic, to be like, surely I can't be the only person who finds this other thing. And I found somebody else mentioned that, like, oh, this is like fan fiction coded side characters relationship over there. I was like, yeah, me too. I thought that. So that's why I'm mentioning that here.
Oh,
as well.
Right.
So how
old is Emily Tesh? I'm sorry to interrupt.
I don't care. It doesn't matter. Again, if that is the thing, I'm guessing 32 or 34, because that's the age of someone who could have gone to Trinity College and University of Chicago and work as a school classics teacher and written two novels or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, this is her first novel, by the way. It shows. All right. So here's the thing. 30 minutes before the end of the audiobook, I'm really struggling to get to the end.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I've just got 30 minutes to go. Like, there's this big action sequence going on, and our main character is doing the stupidest thing possible. And the only way that this could go right before the end of the book is if there's another, you know, Deus Ex Machina, if there's another, you know, God comes out and just saves everyone. That is what happens. Again, it felt like this is why I didn't want to read the last 30 minutes, because I could see where it was going. I was like, she's going to sacrifice herself and she's going to get her found family and all this kind of thing. And then she gets back and meets this alien. And at the end of it, there's this like touching moment where they think they're... Obviously, they're not going to both die because that would like spoil the end of the book. But they think they're both going to die. And she is like, can I touch your hair? And so she touches it, and the alien's like, well, can I touch your hair back? And I'm like, wow, can I touch your hair is, for me, very coded into white women microaggression against black
it's
women.
Like,
can I touch
the most
your hair?
Racist kind of like,
which I
coded.
Learned about like 25 years ago, because I had a friend who had, you know,
an afro.
Yeah, pretty much an afro. At university, and I was like, Mel, can, and then I was like, whoa, like this, and that was when I was like, oh, right, because I saw it happen, other people, that happened with other people, and I was like, oh, right, you know, and I was like, you know, like, slow realization that, you know, the can I touch your hair kind of thing. 25 years.
It's the same kind of question. Where you're from?
And here's the thing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Where are you from? No, but where are you really from? Yes. You're like, no, I'm really
like,
from
where
London.
Where are your parents
yeah.
from?
Oh, where are your parents from? Yeah, my parents are from London. Oh, but where are your parents from? I was like, okay. If we go back like 12 generations somewhere in West Africa that I don't know because there was like slaves in the Caribbean and then came, you know, it's that kind of thing. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is that the can I touch your hair conversation that they had here, I was like, wow, am I missing something here? Is Emily Tesh missing something here? The book isn't well written enough. It sort of just presents this and then moves on. And I'm like, oh, is the...
We just opened another like, topic which like, you are not addressing here.
And I'm like, oh, so is this whole time, is Valkyrie, has she been black? Is the alien black coded? Like, where did this can I touch your hair moment come from? And then it's just dropped and moved on. I was like, Emily... The book isn't well written enough that when something big like this comes up or something chewy that you can chew on, like something that, so this whole time it's been like black coded or race coded or race relations or microaggression. It's just there, dropped in and left. And I looked up other people's reviews on it and other people are like, what the fuck's this? This is like the weirdest scene I've read in a science fiction book. And it comes like 10 minutes before the end of the book. Like we've gone through this whole book and suddenly there's a, can I touch your hair thing? So again, I don't know what to think about this. Emily Tesh isn't a good enough writer to make me feel comfortable that she knows what she's doing with this.
There's literally books which just grapple with this one topic.
Yeah.
Which in books where they have literally like philosophical explorations of what does it mean, how can we deal with it, approach it, be humans about it and stuff, or aliens and humans.
Yeah. It's
that sounds.
I actually just read this blog post which was talking about aliens and like also fantasy races in elves or something like that. It was some comments on, I don't know, it was linked to from somewhere that I read on Blue Sky from another thing. I don't know where it was. Anyway, but they were saying that if you have it to stop people, and this is Tolkien related as
well.
Yeah,
like, I thought so.
Are
yeah.
elves white people and are humans like, you know, are dwarves all Scottish? Mm-hmm. Are hobbits all from, you know, the home counties or, you know, from the Surrey Hills or whatever, you know, whatever it's meant to be? Like, if you're always using alien races or fantasy races as stand-ins for human races, like black people, you know, Asian people, or whatever the thing is, you know.
Yeah, like analogies for
and it's
human
and it's
made
complicated
up categories.
Because it's really difficult to say, oh no, elves are different. Elves look exactly like humans, but they're better than humans in every way.
And they're glowing.
And in two dimensions, like they exist in the spirit world or the magic world and our real world at one time. They can run faster than humans, see faster, like they're better in every way than humans. And in the movie, all of them are white and have blonde hair. Suddenly, it becomes really problematic in that way, which it is, again, I'm not saying it's not problematic in the book. It's like made more problematic to equate elves with white blonde people.
Actually, there's a black elf in the movie.
It doesn't matter. What I'm trying to say is I'm trying to like abstract this out to the point where that if you have any alien that can stand in for any possible group of humanity. It could stand in for white people, it can stand in for black people, it can stand in for women, it can stand in for disabled people, neurodivergent people, people with blue eyes, people who think they're better than everyone, people think they're worse than them. Like, if anything in the book it can stand in for anything about any group of humanity, it becomes problematic to then say, oh, but the reason that they're, I don't know, evil is because they're alien and they think different from us. And it's sort of like, oh yeah, so are you then saying that all Chinese people are evil because they think different from us? And you're like, no, that's not what I'm saying. It's an analogy. And you're in this is really weird complication kind of thing.
Yes.
So in the end, every single alien in these cozy science fiction books have to be 100% exactly analogous to the most basic, like, non-offensive, streamlined, modern, progressive, loves diversity, or, you know what I'm trying to say? It's like everything has to be the least problematic version of itself to ever exist. Otherwise, it's just all going to be humans. Like, everybody is going to be human, and there's not going to be any alien races or fantasy races or anything. Again, I'm not saying that this is good. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not saying I agree with it. I'm saying that it's something complicated. That in the end of these cozy science fiction books, what makes aliens so attractive is that they are indistinguishable from humans that are around in the year 2024, 2025, who have the best possible politics and the best possible relations and are nicest to everyone.
But they destroyed Earth, so how can they be the nicest?
Yeah, but they're the humans, old white men, are the evil ones. That's the message of the book, that if you're old, male and white, it's probably best that we destroy you.
Oof.
But if you are young, gay and progressive, you can destroy worlds, but it's fine because I guess you haven't done that yet in this timeline, even though that we know you're capable of it, but you're young and gay, so whatever. Again, the book itself throws up all these possibilities, doesn't say anything about them, and just has an action sequence, you know, coming of age, young adult rebellion against fascism story.
Right.
But it throws up all of these other issues which are too complicated for me to even want to, like, even now me talking about this, it's like too complicated for me to even bring them up, because it brings up wider issues in the entirety of science fiction and fantasy and what is even being accomplished when you do an analogy to use an alien as an analogy to literally anything except something being so alien that you can't understand it.
Yeah.
You know,
like, it's always about putting people in groups. It's always about saying,
yeah,
this group is,
yeah, exactly,
acting, thinking homogeneously,
yeah,
and everybody in this group is good and everybody in this group is bad.
Yeah, yeah. And but this is saying
it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, I know that's what it's saying, but here they literally have to point out these people are old, but actually they're not the worst people in the world.
Right.
You know what I mean? These people are from a generation above us, and this guy's a man, but we have to be very explicitly told that this older man, this old white man, I don't know if he's white, probably is white actually, but this old white man from a previous generation, we have to be explicit, that has to be explicitly stated by a female character that he can be trusted.
Hmm.
The only trustworthy older white man in the entire book had to be explicitly vouched for by a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, I don't have a problem with in the way that the world is set up, but the book doesn't examine that at another level. Like, it's just stated to be able to fit in with modern, you know, Tor.com publishing, that an older white man has to be explicitly stated that they are good and can be trusted.
Right. I have another question.
Yes.
You said this is cozy science fiction.
That's my final note.
Good, because I'm utterly confused. This doesn't feel like any sort of comforting.
Right, here's the thing. Humans are the most dangerous things in the known world. Violence is bad. But they solve the problems by violence. You know, danger and violence, bad. But to get through every situation, we're going to use danger and violence. So fight scenes and battles. So it feels like it isn't cozy science fiction. It feels like it's like, you know, dystopian fighting against the whatever.
Mm.
by the time we get to the end of the book, it has suddenly all of the tropes of cozy science fiction. In other words, anything challenging, don't need to think about that. You know, all of these different things that I've been talking about, by the end of the book, they are immaterial to the struggle and the effort that's going on in the book.
Right.
All of the stuff about race is mentioned and then discarded. They're like, oh yeah, it is very white around here. You know, we're trying to get the best of humanity. And you think that would reflect all of humanity. And only later does she realize, oh, I was brainwashed and I was a white child. And then, you know, it seems strangely very white around here. She notices when she goes back with the implanted memories of somebody like from a different timeline. Only then does she realize how white it is and how racist it is, whatever. And it's very patriarchal and misogynistic. You know, at one point she mentioned, oh yeah, a third of all the women who go into the creche die. And I'm like, wow, that should...
A third?
Yeah, exactly. And you, the way that your eyes raise there, people just know that on the space station, but then they're like, oh, I guess I'm going to go to the creche. And you're like, yeah, the creche is more dangerous than being a soldier. You know, and I'm like, okay, again, it's like, it feels like not cozy. Everything I'm saying is not cozy here. By the end, of course, we effortlessly save all the women and children and save all the kind of stuff, and we just over, and it just becomes easy. And the what I'm saying about the coziness is that there's this backdrop to the novel of fascism, but and patriarchy and dystopia. But if it's so easily defeated by like children running around with, you know, a computer program that has cheat codes to the universe, and you just know that there's going to be a deus ex machina at the end. But look, the book ends with, like, the coziest possible situation, which is our lesbian main character has got her found family alien person that she's with now. We've got this sentient spaceship that has godlike powers. And now they have, and they fly off into the world with the lesbian, the found family alien, the sentient spaceship, godlike powers, and they're the only people in the world now with this wisdom, godlike powers, and they're gonna just go off into the world and have continuing adventures of Valkyrie and whatever his name, whatever the other thing is, Yiso. It's like Kieran Yiso's long trip to a small angry planet or whatever. You know, honestly, the book ends with, like, after all of this danger, which you know isn't going to be dangerous, all of this sacrifice, which you know isn't going to be sacrifice, all of
for,
this...
For whom? Like, obviously not for them. But
one how, person...
What about the other, like, other one, alien and people and, like...
One person is killed at the end of the book who happens to be the leader of this fascist, you know, space child soldier cult. He dies. Everybody else is saved.
And then they all, like, live in democracy or, like...
It does... It reduces the entire struggle of the book, where at one point in the book, our most dangerous person in the world kills literally trillions of sentient aliens to get revenge for Earth being killed. That's the middle of the book. Okay, the middle of the book is the destruction of thousands and thousands of worlds by the most powerful and most dangerous character in fiction that I've ever heard. He's literally Thanosing, snapping, and not killing 50% of people. He's killing trillions of people and leaving just a few, like leaving the humans and just a few planets left over. So imagine somebody who is more dangerous, more evil, and actually did the Thanos snap better than Thanos ever did it. Okay, by the end, he's the hero. He's one of the heroes at the end of the book.
What?
Exactly. This book, I don't understand how this book can have, like, can someone who's obviously read Ender's Game gets to the end of Ender's Game and you're like, oh yeah, Ender is like got massive PTSD from killing an entire alien race and sending all these people knowing that he's all done that. Like, Ender, at the end of the book, is fucked up and takes, like, another four books written by Orson Scott Card to, like, get over, like, and make amends to it, you know? Yeah. You got Speaker for the Dead and you got the other one and Xenocide and things like that. Like, it's all about... And the end of this book is sort of like, yay, we defeated the old fascist guy who wanted to rape me earlier on in the book. And now I've got we're the only two in the world, the only two people in the universe with godlike powers. Everything's fine. Earth has been destroyed, but that's a price worth paying to save the cute aliens who speak with cute voices. Look, I don't know what this book is trying to say. This book is so all over the place that if there is like a political message to it, it is so hidden within the messiness of the storytelling and the messiness of the book and like how everything just crumbles away. I don't know how to approach this book. Like, I don't even know what the politics of this book are, because it's like cozy science fiction buzzwords being thrown in and like modern 2025 inclusion speak and therapy speak and self-care, or, you know, all of this stuff that's around in the world, but just like thrown at this book, where I'm like, hey, Hunger Games, like it wasn't trying to also grapple with, you know, like, it was grappling with one thing. It was grappling with like hyper violence and, you know, children being brought up in the world seeing violence and all this different kind of thing. There's lots of stuff going on there, but they didn't also try and, can I touch your hair, gay characters, you know, all this different kind of stuff that's thrown in there. Sometimes you're like, look, if you're doing young adult, just have like a normal love triangle, you know, with a girl not being able to decide between two boys and defeat the fascism in the end. And you don't have to, like, I don't know. Like, it's sort of like, if something's written from the point, like from a young adult, cozy science fiction-y kind of vibe, all of this other stuff feels like a distraction. Mm. You either got to address all of this stuff.
Yeah.
Like, address the uncomfortableness of the power dynamics here, or don't, and stop bringing them up so much and just have a fun space adventure. Have a fun child soldier defeating space fascism space adventure.
Yeah, I think that is one of the huge big things I have seen in recent books a lot. And of course, it has kind of to do with, you know, a certain kind of generation growing up in the world that has too many issues thrown at you at any point. And I understand that. But if you're writing stories, you can't then suddenly throw all of them in and then not addressing them and not having your characters come to conclusions or, you know, have meaning that you're saying something, because the more you throw at it, the less it anything means. And
I was astounded that I got to the end of this book and there wasn't an explicit mention of a trans character.
Yeah.
And I know that's weird for me to say. And again, I'm not saying it like good or bad in that stuff. It's sort of like, it's strange, if you know what I mean, to have a book like this, a Hugo winner, published by Tor.com. Tor.com/Orbit Books. Mm. And there not to be an explicit mention of a trans character.
Non-binary.
Again, I don't know if it's non-binary or whatever it's going to be, but that isn't mentioned in this, which again, I'm not saying is good or bad or anything. I'm just saying it's like, you know, it's a different issue.
Mm.
Whereas like the, like Alien Clay, which is like the top book. All right, it's not the top book. It's the first one listed here in the 2025 thing. That's like explicitly about, you know, trans identity. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a trans character in it, but the whole thing is about a very British point of view saying, you know, trans, you know, non-binary isn't a thing. And the whole book is like, non-binary is a thing. That's like kind of one of the main points of the book. Even though it's not explicitly saying that, it is much more explicitly talking about that. You know, not more explicitly. That can be much more easily read into a book like that.
Yeah.
Into a book like Alien Clay. And that's why, one of the reasons why I gave it 4 stars, you gave it 5 stars. And it's like, you know, it's a book that will hold up, even if I found it disappointing in some ways. There are these ways, you know, these ways of looking at it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In this book, again, nothing to do with the trans or not, but like, I don't even know. Like, it's so difficult for me to even feel like what the author is saying about gay identity, that the only reason you ever know that you're gay, or the way that you know that you're gay, is that you in another alternate timeline is gay, and now you have their gay memories. So now you have the memory of kissing somebody, not your own memory, but somebody else. But again, it's too complicated that it, and it feels like, and again, I don't know if Emily Tesh is gay or not or whatever like that. I don't even need to look it up, but it feels like a kind of like one step removed fan fiction version of it. It's sort of like, here's a character. Oh, I mostly finished the book and then had an idea that they could be gay. So let's go back and write in that, you know.
Right,
you know,
it's like the equivalent to Alien, the movie, or no, what is it, Aliens?
Where the first Alien movie,
Ripley wasn't a woman, and then
this would work if she's a woman. And so yes. And then the director gets hold of the script and like, oh, well, this has got lots of stuff about,
the topics...
Yeah,
change because you have the different person as the main character.
Look, who knows? It's difficult for me to come to a conclusion about the book because it felt like it had so much promise at the start.
Yeah.
But by wanting to do everything, like it wanted to be young adult, it wanted to be not young adult, it wanted to be like dystopian and gritty. And so, grim cozy is what I put at the end. It's sort of like it's got this veneer of grimness on it, like grim, dark stuff, like of nihilism or whatever. And like, oh, our main character is a child soldier who's been brought up and she is racist and she is homophobic and she is sexist. She is, you know, misogynistic. She is a bully to everybody else. And nobody likes her. There's a great scene where all of her people, like all of her classmates who go off in different directions are like, well, all of us hated you and I hated you, and there was never a moment where like we should have done, I was your main rival and you were always bullying us and commanding us, and of course you're going to go into command and we all hated you, goodbye. And I'm like, that's a great scene. It's got some teeth to it
and it has room for growth and development. You'd think it could have a point of self-reflection and learning and discovering.
But instead she's sort of like, oh, I don't want to become a baby machine. I'll escape and go and save my brother. And it's all just left behind. And when she gets back to that situation, that whole situation has been solved by her having like a personality transplant from another timeline. Where she had to like learn the... the lessons of friendship.
No, but then she didn't learn anything. If she had it transplanted, the original
she never
core
has,
person
yeah, she never
didn't
has to,
learn anything.
She just no, she never learns anything. She just stays stupid. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, it's so tricky for me to dig down into this book because every single time that I like thought about anything for like 3 seconds more, I'm like, well, that doesn't make sense because of this, or oh, that's unsatisfying because of this, or oh, if you just have cheat codes of the universe, this happens, or what are the power dynamics? Why aren't, like, she notices that everybody around her is white, you know, when she gets back to the space station, but what does that mean? It doesn't mean anything. Sort of like, oh yeah, it is a bit white. I was like, examine what that means. Like, think about...
And does it have an effect on her what she's doing?
Yeah. How will you now act differently?
Yes.
And I'm like, great. And she gets to the end and she does the can I touch your hair moment. And I'm like, but you just... Like, what didn't you... Like, I know this is an alien and not alien. Like, but what is this message? Like, what does it mean? And again, I don't want every book to have a message. Sometimes I just want, like, young child soldiers, like, defeating a fascist regime or getting, like, growing up in a Hunger Games situation or whatever it's going to be.
Yeah.
Like, that's going to be fine. That's what a book can be. But, oh, man, just talk about, like, lobbing over the representation grenades into this book and just, it's like, wow, it just doesn't hold up. It just doesn't hold up under the weight of its own... goals, just because the craft of the writing there and the plotting isn't there and the pacing isn't there and just sort of like what a good story can be. Won the Hugo, of course it did, because it's like it's a perfect novel for this kind of thing.
Yes. Can I have two things that I want to address here.
Yeah, of course.
One is, I think, again, and I think I've said it in the past, Hugo, and I'm including Nebula just because it's an award, I don't think it has anything to say anymore about the quality of a book or how satisfying, how well written, how
good. We've talked about this for 15 years.
I know. And you keep coming back to it and keep being, I wouldn't say you're disappointed, but you keep getting the same results over and over. I think the only time you should read a Hugo or Nebula winning book from now going forward is... if it has been 10 years in the past.
So you think I should always do, I should put a 10-year block on Hugh. The thing is, some of them I've read because they're books I want to read anyway. This was a book that I wanted to read anyway that happened to have won the Hugo last year.
Oh, okay,
like,
good.
There wasn't the reason.
So
just,
you didn't read it because again, it came up to onto your radar because it won.
It came onto my radar because it was nominated and then it gets talked about on other podcasts.
Oh, right.
Like the now I just listen to, and you know, I just listen to the first bit of one of the podcasts from the Incomparable, and they always read all of the Hugo and Nebula nominated ones and
but
do a
they
discussion.
They do it for you.
They do it for me. Oh yeah. And that's what they were just mentioning again with Adrian Tchaikovsky, that somebody was reading it one way and somebody was reading it another way, this Alien Clay. Mm-hmm. And someone said, oh, I got this out of it and I didn't get something. You know, that's why I just brought that up. Yeah. Also, it's listed right here.
Yeah.
And that's why I was bringing up that as an example of something which has a trans character in it, which says something about, like, the whole book can say something about it.
Yes.
And so some of these books I will read because they come into my attention, because they're on the Hugo or Nebula list. But it doesn't mean that I'm wanting to read the winner more than others.
Right, that makes sense.
I will read at some point Anne Leckie's translation state, probably. There's absolutely no way I'm reading anything by Martha Wells, this Witch King, or John Scalzi's Starter Villain. Those are just...
Yeah, it's almost the same names, isn't it?
They're just not going to be there. Like, they're never going to come into my reading list. They're never going to make it onto my to-read list. Whereas Some Desperate Glory was on my to-read list, and here it is, and it was at 4.06, and it just got on, it just made it on, if you know what I mean. It just it just became the next book that I had in my reading list.
The other thing is a little bit side tangential.
Yeah.
Yesterday we watched a video where somebody explained about music, library music.
Yeah.
And just if you don't know about this, look up the concept of library. Yeah. It's quite fascinating, interesting stuff. And we talked about the fact that it had certain rules about restrictions that this music had to adhere to. And I think this is something that young writers or even like middle-aged writers could do a bit more.
What?
Give yourself restrictions.
No, yeah, could do. But
because, you know...
I don't want a novel that feels like a writing exercise, though.
Yeah, but... No, not a writing exercise, but just a slight... Okay, there are too many topics. I can't address it. It's a little bit like writing a thesis,
yes.
You know?
Yeah, I don't understand. Yeah.
You can't... Like, but when you
look,
start...
this is Emily Tesh's... It's her first novel.
Yeah, I know.
Everybody
but when
wants
you
to
start,
put everything in their first novel.
When you start researching a topic... you will find more and more subtopics to the topic. And as interesting as that is, you can always then continue on later, but you have to restrict yourself to one or two main core things that you can address, that you can satisfactorily address in a way that is interesting and meaningful.
Yeah.
And there's no way in the whole world that you could write an essay or a book about what's happening in the world, even in our world, and have it...
Here is a book about everything.
Everything.
Yeah, I get
it. It's like, what did it well was literally the movie Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Yeah.
That is as far as you can go with that.
You can talk about the experience of... always having to think about and deal with and have an opinions about Everything Everywhere All at Once.
And it has been done.
I do understand that. Yeah, I mean, but that is a lot of what time travel is. It's sort of like, suddenly I have all the responsibility and I can fix everything and Groundhog Day and I can fix this person, I can catch this child falling out of a tree. You know, all of those different things.
But then
that
you're addressing that.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. You're addressing what it is like to have to address everything all at once.
Exactly. Is then your topic.
Yeah, good. Good point. All right, so... I didn't want to get too down into the weeds about the Hugo Awards. Like I say, I have read a few of these Hugo and Nebula Awards, like this one, Babel, or The Necessity of Violence, an Arcane History of the Oxford Translators Revolution. That probably would have won the Hugo Award, except the Hugo Awards were given out in China that year, and for various reasons, a book featuring a half-Chinese student... from Oxford was somehow like left out of the nominating somehow, I don't know. Either way, look, it's fine. This book in the end is, I didn't enjoy it because there was just too much in it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give it 2 stars.
Okay.
And that is, I think, kind of generous for a
modern
book.
I was about to say, two stars. You gave two stars to books that you kind of like, yeah, okay.
You wanted to talk me down to 1.5 stars.
I don't know. We just had an hour-long podcast.
There wasn't except for that last... until I got to the last 30 minutes. Yeah, I think... yeah, let's go 1.5 stars. Because, yeah, that last 30 minutes was rough. Like, that are getting to the last 30 minutes of a book and, like, really struggling to build up the motivation and effort to get through that last 30 minutes. Yeah, let's say 1.5 stars.
We haven't even talked about the audiobook itself yet.
The audiobook was fine. I disliked some of the ways that the audiobook narrator decided to impose on the alien character, Yisu, cuteness. By doing a voice which made them sound like a character from a children's TV show. It's literally like Elmo or like Teletubby there. And I'm like, don't do that. And then like the young frail gay character, suddenly like, oh yeah. And anyway, I'm just saying, like, audiobook narrator.
Voice coding.
Yeah, there's a bit, again, it was mostly the alien because it was like, it was kind of like a main character for like a lot of the book and was just annoying to listen to. Mm. And I want the text of the book to tell me that something is young and cute and fun to hang out with or whatever it's going to be, rather than, you know, making them sound like the new cool cousin that they bring into a sitcom because all the kids have grown up and aren't cute anymore. Right. So let's bring in cousin Jackie or whatever it is. And I'm like, hello, I'm then the new cute precocious one, the cousin who comes over. And you're like, oh, fuck. And that's what this felt like, you know, and I don't want my characters in a book, which I think is going to be serious science fiction, to have the voice of like a Muppet and a cute Muppet.
Yeah. What do other?
I finished this podcast 15 minutes ago. The reason it's going longer is because you keep asking questions, which I've got no problem with. But we were aiming for a podcast under an hour.
I already looked, and it is a bit longer. Yeah. Anyway, what do the people on Goodreads say, and your friends on Goodreads?
Yeah, 5 stars from Lindsay, Margaret 5 stars, oh. Terp Christian 4 stars, Tom 4 stars, Ronald 3 stars.
Oh, that's a long review.
Yeah, please be aware this book contains all kind of triggers: sexual assault, sexism, suicide, racism. It's a long list, and you should make sure to read the full list of triggers at the start of the book. So, trigger warning. Here's the thing: all of those trigger warnings, and it felt completely non-challenging to me. Mm. Like that someone commits suicide, I'm like, yeah, kind of what should have happened at that point in the book. Yeah, sure, whatever. You know, that's the kind of thing. Sexual assault at this assault. Yeah, I saw this rape scene coming like 4 chapters ago and now I'm here. I'm going to feel uncomfortable in this moment. But you know what? Was no rape. The rape didn't happen. Maybe attempted groping and kissing. And I'm like, oh, right, that's what we're building up to. Some creepy man like trying to feel up a 17-year-old. I was like, well, sure, whatever. Like, trigger warnings, fine. Yeah, no, I get it. I get there's a trigger warnings in, but everything is resolved so easily and, like, come on. I honestly want a book, like, to have a list of trigger warnings to actually trigger me. And that does happen. Like,
I'm
okay to be affected by depictions of bad things which should have trigger warnings. Go for it. But you can't just opt out of, like, you can't get to those things and then just be like, meh, actually not like that. Yeah, lots of 3-star reviews. Yeah, but that was it. I looked at some, like, what I was thinking, like, 2-star reviews to try and find other people who are like, wait, touch my hair. Let's see if I can touch your... touch your hair. I was going to search it there, but it doesn't work. Maybe it's hair. Maybe I can find it. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Here's one of those. Oh, that's really funny. This is a review I didn't notice at the time by Rebecca Roanhorst. Do you know Rebecca Roanhorst?
Yeah, she's an author.
Yeah, I read works by him. So there's one scene I have to mention, not in a good way. I'm just baffled by it. The main character, now enlightened, asks to touch the alien's hair, and the alien consents. The hair is springy. It's springy. And then asks to touch the main character's hair. I gasped. Is this an acknowledgement that the main character still has a long way to go to understand racism? Is this a neoliberal cry that we are all curious about each other's hair and that what brings us together? And that's what brings us together? Or is it something else that I'm simply not getting? I have to assume that a white woman writing about fascism and racism specifically against black people is aware of the politics of black hair and deliberately chose to add an alien hair-touching scene. It was jarring, and I'm truly curious to why it is there. I was having those same reactions, and that's why I went to Goodreads to find somebody else to who had the same
that is actually really
reaction.
Interesting to have another author.
Yeah, and it's the second review, you know,
cool.
With 259 likes. Yeah, and that's the kind of thing sort of like I'm like ah! Like, but the whole book is sort of like, oh, you bring your genocide and xenocide and fascism and all this kind of thing. And I'm like, and what you're saying about it is, I throw my hands in the air and I'm like, shrug, whatever. Good if white
Here's
people
another topic
do it, humans
that,
do
that,
it. Bad
that
if old white people do it, but someone is, yeah. Oh, I'm just like, oh, I don't know, I like this.
Hmm. Cool. All right. Good, I think.
As you can see from my reaction to the hair-touching scene, I think this book's success will depend a lot on the reader and their level of engagement and sophistication with the big topics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah. Whatever.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Shall I wait the other 6 weeks for the book to become available on the library
Honestly,
app?
What I think you should do, what I think what you could enjoy, I think one way enjoying this book is to treat it as one novella that ends at that third of the way point.
Right.
As soon as there's the first like major Deus Ex Machina where everything in the world is put right again by an alien power so powerful it can rewind time 20 years to put everything right. I would say stop at that moment and be like, hey, that was a pretty good novella.
Cool.
Honestly,
I will.
Because it doesn't need to examine the fallout of all of its things that it's mentioned and the politics so far. And I'd be like, yeah, pretty good. 3.5-star novella if you stop this book 1/3 of the way through.
Okay, I will. Awesome.
If it comes up, read it and then just like don't carry on.
Okay.
So that's fun.
What's in your next book?
Oh, I was rereading Day of the Triffids just because I'm just ticking off some of these SFB must reads books to check if I still think they're must reads.
Yeah.
I didn't realize how short it was, and I'm already almost at the end. So maybe I may or may not do a podcast about that.
Aren't there a few of these podcasts about the Day of the Triffids
I reread The Time Machine and was like, yeah, Time Machine again. But yeah, of course, it's fine. That's a reread just for me. And I think there was another book that I read last year, which I was like, yeah, that was just for me. Yeah. Might not need to do a podcast. I've already done two previous SFBRPs about Day of the Triffids.
Yes,
it's a short book. Not sure what else I have to add except that. Yeah, good. Good fun storytelling.
Does it hold up?
Hey,
yes or no?
There's moments in that book where I was like, I would love one moment as good as that in Emily Tesh's Some Desperate Boy. There's a point where he's looking out over London.
Yeah.
And she's sort of like, oh, you're saying goodbye too. He's all like, yeah, I am saying goodbye too. And I'm like, oh, that's so great. Someone can just be in control enough about something that you can write a scene and then one other character can mention something and it casts the whole scene in a different light.
Yeah.
And it reflects back. And then what she's doing is one way of saying goodbye. He's saying goodbye. They do this. You know, there's this whole thing that goes on and it's just a small scene of one person looking at something and one person commenting. And I was like, oh, I wish Emily Tesh could write a scene which doesn't read like, you know, stage directions for a blockbuster movie.
I get what I mean? Yeah,
where everything's explicit and stated and then someone has to notice this and do this and it's all internal. And you can just be like, no, just write something from just someone looking out a window and noticing something and someone commenting on it.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's such a beautiful moment in the book. Mm. And it's a book full of death. And just people dying and suicide all the time. And you just read it and you're like, oh, there's so many beautiful moments. Like, it's not beautiful. I'm saying the writing, there's so
meaningful.
Much, yeah, it's so much poetic writing there.
Yeah.
As
poetic
well.
Writing. Yeah,
it can be there. And also there's an explicit, hey, we're restarting humanity and women have to be baby machines and men have to work. You know, it's strange enough, like one scene, although the audiobook is a bit weird that like codes the guy with like a German accent at that point when he's talking about like, oh, we've got to restart humanity and bring out the best of our race. And I was like, audiobook narrator, maybe don't give that person a German accent. Maybe it's in the book. I'd have to reread it to hear that.
That is very strange.
Either way, a good writer could put moments in a book which elevate a whole book. Day of the Triffids is like a 6-hour audiobook. Some Desperate Glory, like 15 hours or something.
Mm.
Like way too long. Yeah, it's 16 hours, 15 hours and 56 minutes.
Yeah.
And just loses control of the book. Right, we've gone an hour and 15 minutes. I wanted to go 50 minutes and we put an extra 25 minutes at the end of this podcast.
Yeah.
Don't worry, it was a joint effort to go long.
It was. All right.
Right, let's go on holiday. We're going to have some lunch and then head over and do some family visits and
awesome.
Visit some, hopefully, beautiful German towns with medieval city centres.
Yes.
Let's give it a go. Thanks a lot. I'm not going to do any blurbs or anything. Thanks a lot for listening and we'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.
Oh, where's the stop button?